Andrew Talks to Chefs is an independent podcast. For current and past episodes, Andrew's blog, contact information, and more, please visit andrewtalkstochefs.com. To support us, please visit patreon.com/andrewtalkstochefs. Enjoy the show.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stone.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
I read Romance of Three Dynasty a lot. It's a Chinese novel.
Okay.
History slash novel thing. Kind of art of war related kind of thing.
Okay.
And they talk about different war formations. The formation that is the strongest is the formation where you have your back against the river. There's just no way out of this situation other than forward. And I think that's the situation that I was in when I was opening this restaurant.
That is the voice of Simon Kim, the restaurateur behind Coat Restaurant in New York City. He is our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses
to make some sense of this.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and our guest today is none other than Simon Kim. Simon is the owner and restaurateur behind Coat Restaurant in New York City. And if you know anything about New York City restaurants, then you know Coat. It is a celebrated, sophisticated, distinctly New York take on a Korean steakhouse. We actually had Coat's chef, David Shim, on the show last year. And now I'm just thrilled to have Simon on the show. Coat is Simon's second restaurant following the also very well-received Peora in Lower Manhattan several years ago. Before I launch into this interview, I just want to mention that Coat is participating in the program we've been telling you about the last few weeks, organized by our friends at San Pellegrino, also this podcast promotional partner, titled Destination Dining. The program invites those of us who can't or aren't traveling at this time to satisfy our culinary wanderlust by enjoying a dish from a different city. The inaugural Destination Dining series features a month's worth of exchange dishes between restaurants in Los Angeles and New York. Each week of the series, a restaurant in New York will feature a dish from an LA restaurant, and that LA restaurant will in turn feature a dish from their New York counterpart. And the program benefits ROAR New York. That name, ROAR, R-O-A-R, stands for Relief Opportunities for All Restaurants. This week, Coat will be serving Jonathan Yao, the chef from Kato's, Charsu American Wagyu with lettuce and herb bundles. And Kato in Los Angeles will be serving Coat's steak and eggs with hand-cut filet mignon tartare, royal hybrid caviar, and milk toast. And those dishes are available through this Friday. And did I say month-long a minute ago? I actually meant to say five-week-long because the people at San Pellegrino have added a fifth week to the series with a great pair following Coat and Kato, Mozza in Los Angeles, and Resdora in New York City will be the next pair in the Destination Dining series. Look for news about that in a few days. So Simon Kim and I sat down a few weeks ago. We met outside Coat. As you probably know, all restaurants or most restaurants in New York City are taking a crack at outdoor dining. Some are doing it quite stylishly. Coat is definitely one of those. They had just installed their outdoor heaters, which are pretty cool. They're actually, I believe, infrared. They go under the table and they work great. Simon and I sat down. We had a meal together after this interview. It was just a great, spontaneously long conversation we had. I absolutely loved it and how much Simon opened up and shared about his story and his own, I guess what I would call his own interior journey. It's pretty great stuff. I really love it. And I hope you do too. And I hope you love it as much as I do. And with that, let's get you to my conversation with Simon Kim of Coat Restaurant in New York City. Here you go.
Why don't you catch me up just for a moment? We're sitting here. It's early October. It's gotten a little overcast in the last few minutes, but it was a spectacular afternoon today in New
York.
Beautiful
day.
Almost like a summer day. We're sitting outside here under the canopy. You've started doing indoor dining at 25% capacity. But just, you know, what's the ride been like for you over the last 6+ months?
It's by far and most definitely the most challenging 6 months of my life, you know.
Of your life, not just
absolutely.
In the business.
Yeah, absolutely. By long shot. It was really crazy when middle of March, when government mandated closure, we were like a deer caught in a headlight. You know, what do? You know, restaurant people, we don't close restaurants,
yeah.
You know, no matter what. You lose an arm, you know, the restaurant remains open. Right. And other people carry on. But to close the restaurant, probably one of the most fearful thing. And hence, that is why during the past 6 and some months, we're closed for less than 10 days. We immediately pivoted into delivery.
Mm-hmm.
And people were like, how does a Michelin-starred Korean steakhouse that you cook on the table turn into a delivery? And we figured it out, you know, thanks to our team. So we pivoted early on, and that was not enough. And because we wanted to keep the team going, we didn't want to furlough people. So we needed to find another revenue stream. So we started selling steaks as a steak care package to people who are leaving out of town. Because there's a shortage in beef as well,
mm-hmm.
especially the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then that eventually turned into a national delivery platform through a Goldbelly. But I got sick in April as well.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And that's when I sent my wife and my kids to Korea, where my parents are, so they can, you know, because Korea remained open. So I wanted them to have access because they're just kids. So I was home by myself. I got COVID. Got pretty bad. I was sick for 15 days.
Oof. Did you have it to the like just laid out? Like
it was pretty bad. So I was sick for about total 15 days, and after 1 week, the final 1 week was actually very serious until it got immediately better. So literally, I feel like, you know, business came to a verge of a bankruptcy. Myself, I thought that I was, you know, anything much worse, who knows what would have happened. So
mm-hmm.
I feel like it really went through so much, life-threatening and business life-threatening. And now as we open indoor, I feel like this storm is far from being over, but I do see light at the end of the tunnel.
You feel like you've been through the worst of it.
I think so.
Can I ask, I mean, we just started talking. I've only met you maybe twice before, very briefly. We spoke at the Welcome Conference last year, and I think I saw you in the restaurant once. You know, when you talk about being on the verge of every kind of calamity, really, you could have, right, your personal health and your professional health. You know, as we sit here today, you seem very calm. You know, you seem very steady. What do you have any sense? Did you know going into that dark period that you had what it took to get out of it? Like, did you really get tested in a way that you could have ever imagined in your life?
Definitely, I got tested, you know, Andrew, like, I really don't think anyone, right? No one saw what was in the pipeline, right? We thought that it's closing, probably we're going to reopen in 2 weeks or, you know,
or
maybe a month
yeah.
or maybe two, you know? So now I feel very fortunate. What I discovered throughout this pandemic is that, you know, you're nothing. You know, I myself am nothing, you know, in grand, you know, I run a 120-seat restaurant, and without my team, literally, I couldn't have done anything, right? So in the beginning, it was actually just a survival mode. How do I keep as many people who on the core management team as much as possible, and how do I keep the restaurant going, right? I wanted to continuously pay my vendors, like, you know, my steak guys that I have a relationship with, you know, vegetable produce guys. And it kind of started more as how do we stay afloat with as many people on the boat as possible? You know, I think that's how it started. And in the beginning, it was really bad, you know, especially like in middle of April when like the frozen trucks were kind of, you know, in certain parts of New York City, because the morgues were getting filled, you know.
Yeah, for people who don't watch the news a lot, or what Simon's referring to was there were these makeshift morgues outside of hospitals that were basically giant refrigerated trailers or trucks.
And so some of my kitchen staff, when they left their home to come to work, they saw that, you know. Yeah. And in the beginning, it was really, really difficult because part of me thought that I wanted to keep the restaurant open and keep going with the delivery and keep the lights on. But part of me is like, am I jeopardizing my employees' health? And like, how do you make that decision, you know? But, you know, speaking with my team, they were gracious and brave and courageous enough and loyal enough to say that, you know what, let's keep going. And since then, in the beginning, I feel like as the owner of the business, I felt like not following them and keeping the lights on, I thought I was kind of pulling them. But 6 months later, I'm literally just riding on my team's torque, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talk to my guys. I'm like, I'm the horsepower guy. I go, vroom, you know, and you guys are the torque that definitely carries all the weight and, you know, all the good stuff. So
yeah.
I'm so grateful.
Yeah.
And the little glimpse of hope and, you know, the actually pretty large dose of, you know, hope that I'm able to feel, I give that 100% to my team.
Great. Thank you for sharing all that.
My pleasure.
So Let's get into your story. You, I have to say, I was doing my research to come talk to you, and there were a lot of things that surprised me that I'm really dying to talk to you about. But let's start at the beginning. You were born in Seoul, is that correct?
Sure. I was born and raised in Seoul until I was 13 years old.
And as I understand it, your transit to the United States was spurred by your academic situation.
That is not 100% because I was not big. So I have two older siblings,
mm-hmm.
and they're both artists.
Okay.
And back then, Korean education was a little more one-dimensional. Everyone had to kind of follow a certain curriculum, and anyone that doesn't fit into that curriculum kind of was not necessarily viewed as a good student, if you will. And noticing my brother, older brother, and my sister is more of an artist, a little different mind, my parents wanted to send them to America for educational purposes. So they sent them to boarding school, art school in California.
Oh, that's why they came. Okay.
And meanwhile, I'm the third child. I'm the happy child. You know, very little tutoring. I was just one of those guys that played in playground as long as I possibly can, kind of. Because my parents are focused on my older siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I was not excelling in academia because what do you do when your mom is kind of coming in and out of America and Korea?
Mm-hmm.
So I really just kind of hung out, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And then my grades were bad. So my mother thought that, you know what, we can't have family split in between. So we should just pack up and all go to America. And that's when I came to the States.
I've interviewed a number of people of Korean descent on the show. Academics. Important.
Absolutely.
In most families of people I've spoken to, one of them is restaurant is right around the corner from here, Hoonie Kim.
Sure. Love Hoonie.
When
it's
Hoonie, you know, he told me when he told his mom he was going to become a chef, they didn't talk for a year. You know, he said it was, you know, lawyer, doctor. His joke was if you, you know, weren't successful, accountant. Right?
Sure.
So you have two siblings who go the art route, and then here you are, not particularly... for whatever reason, just not particularly responsive to traditional classroom education. Were your parents unusually, I don't even know what the right word would be, were they a little unconventional or more progressive? Were they more receptive to their children going a different route?
Absolutely. I am immensely thankful to my parents for being so accepting of what we wanted to do.
Yeah.
So both my brother and sister all pursued art path, which is very unconventional because especially to send to private school abroad and pay for the tuitions, and that's not pursuing the doctor or
right. It's not
lawyer.
Going to medical. You're not going to Stanford Medical School.
Exactly.
You're going to an arts. Right.
Yeah. So naturally, kind of my brother was a very super talented like art genius. He kind of paved the way. So when I said I wanted to pursue restaurant, and my father was actually probably one of the biggest gastronomes that I know.
Mm.
Yes. So I almost kind of, I tell the story how my father was so critical all the time. So he had a polio at young age. So he was not very mobile. So instead of taking me and my siblings to play catch or hiking or outdoor activities, he always took us to fine dining restaurants, because that's where he felt, you know, comfortable, and, you know,
he took a lot of joy in that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So he wanted to share that with you.
Exactly. So he loved, like, you know, good food, good wine, good books, good, you know, speakers, and those coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, I kind of grew up appreciating those. And my mother, knowing that food actually brings our family together, the common denominator, so she really kind of became an amazing, amazing cook. Hmm. So I kind of tell a story how growing up, my father is the Michelin inspector.
Okay.
And my mother is the Michelin star chef.
Okay.
To try to please the critic, if you will.
Got it. So she learned to cook to satisfy that part of your father's makeup.
Pretty much.
She started cooking out of as a nod to his sort of enthusiasm for it.
Pretty much, yes. My mother is kind of a superwoman to me.
Mm-hmm.
She was a stage actress growing up, you know, when she was in college days. And she married my father, and she founded three different companies in while raising us. So she's super talented, kind of a not very traditional Korean woman. So every dinner was the most important thing. You know, that's when my father, who's very introvert, so he never really asked me how was your school, you know, how are you doing. It was more along the lines of, is this tempura crispy enough, or is the shrimp inside moist enough? You know, that was the kind of the conversation. So, knowing my father, knowing the kids are having a great time being with their father. So my mother naturally really cooked really stimulating and exciting food every night.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That sounds like a great way to grow up.
I think so. And also, funny thing is, my older siblings are more like my father. They're a little more introvert. They're a little more like, you know, for lack of better explanation, my dad was a big prince, right? Like, he just kind of wanted my mom to take care of him.
Mm-hmm.
With him. He's like a man-child, if you will, in a very respectable way, you know?
Right.
And so was my sister and my brother. They kind of like being taken care of, if you
mm-hmm.
will. So my mother, you know, really kind of took care of them, and I was basically her sidekick. I liked to provide service, and I was the maitre d' of the family, right? I was the one that, like, did some funny tricks, always had something funny to say.
At the table.
Exactly. Because otherwise, my mother was cooking, and three other people, my dining companions, were a little more of like, so tell me what's funny, you know? So I was the maitre d', my mom was the chef, if you will.
And that was a natural, I mean, it sounds like that was a natural extension or reflection of your personality?
Absolutely.
As it was developing?
Sure.
So you come to New York State, yeah?
Mm-hmm. I come to Long Island, a town called Manhasset.
Mm-hmm. How was that decided?
So I think my mother and came and kind of looked a lot of different suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
That was ideal to raise the family. So I think we went to L.A., to certain parts of California, and they went to Virginia, to Fairfax, and which is a cool area. And then she went to Long Island to check it out. So she kind of traveled a lot, and then finally came to Manhattan, and she fell in love with it. And she's like, you know what? I want to stay here. And the rest is history.
Okay, so you come there, what, at age 13?
That's correct, yes.
And how was the, I mean, you didn't speak English.
No, I mean, I knew how to say hello.
So you were an unshy kid, but you don't speak the language. You come over to the burbs of New York, and your reception was, what was that transition like for you?
Transition from Korea to here was really interesting, because I really enjoyed kind of transitioning into America, because I look forward to it. America is, you know, growing up in Korea, coming to America is, you know, Disney World and, mm-hmm. you know, what have you. So we're really excited to come, but nerve-wracking at the same token, because I was not a complete, like, you know, toddler. You know, I was 13, which is kind of reaching puberty mm-hmm. Stage, and I had my set of group of friends and, you know, my clique, and I was very social, so I had, you know, many, many friends, and I was very much accepted socially, and to just leave all that behind and to fit in. It was really difficult, and especially in the beginning because I didn't speak the language. I got bullied a lot, but I don't think it was anything ill-intentioned. You know, it was a new kid. They all grew up in a, you know, same elementary school, same middle school, you know, the whole thing. And, you know, new person. So they were, some of them are curious, but of course some of them wanted to, you know, bully me.
Physically?
Definitely. Yes. So I remember this was an earth science class,
you know,
and everyone knew that because it's a very small school. It's a beautiful school, but with very small classes. And so everyone knew the new kid, you know, from Korea, which is even more odd, right? It was a class. In the middle of the class, I remember this kid who was kind of scoping me out. You just kind of know, right? When somebody's got eye on you to kind of...
That's when your, like, animal instincts kick in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This guy is trying to, like, mess with me. I knew.
You could feel that you were, like, the prey.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, like, growing up in Korea, I was actually very, like, I was very much of an anti-bully because I think my brother kind of bullied me in a very natural way, right? Older mm-hmm. brother kind of bullies a younger brother. So I kind of, like, resisted bullying very hard. So in Korea, I got into a lot of fist fights, and after a while, no one ever bullied with me, you know? So came to New York, and when I saw the guy looking at me, I was like, I know this kind of feeling, you know? So he came over, and he said something that I don't know, and I basically gestured, I have no problem, like kind of putting my hands up, and this guy, like, knocked my head off. So naturally, I just... natural instinct, I just punched him in the face. And teacher saw it, but teacher knew that the other guy was bullying, right? So I didn't get into any trouble. And I think that was the end of the story. And from then on, no one really bullied me.
Wow. That's like what they say when you go into prison, right? Like you take a shot at the biggest guy, let people know you can't be you can't be messed with.
Right.
Yeah, right.
It definitely was the case. And then from then on it was really, really pleasant, right? And other people, there was no more bullying. And again, I love socializing. I learned how to rollerblade. So a bunch of rollerblading clique got together, and I really assimilated really quickly.
You did. Did you pick up the language pretty fast?
So 4 years after I came to the States was the first time I headed back to Korea. I actually had a very hard time speaking Korean.
You had a hard time shifting back.
Yes, because I just really kind of assimilated, and they accepted me, and... you know, sleepovers, to PlayStations, to rollerblading. So, you know, I guess 13 is still young enough. Especially I love socializing. So I feel like I didn't speak any Korean for 4 years. I really just kind of...
Wow. So in the home, you guys spoke English at home?
At home, we spoke Korean. But again, like...
But you were 13, so you were like mostly out.
Exactly.
I have to ask you about this. I've seen it in more than one interview. You just mentioned, you know, that you would... you know, when back home in Korea, you would, you know, slug someone if they tried to bully you. I have heard that you had a propensity, I don't even know if we call it a hobby, but that you had a period in your life where bar fights were a thing with you?
Yes.
Can I ask you about this?
Sure.
Okay, I'm sensing a reluctance. Yeah. Would you rather not?
No, let's go. Let's go for it. Yes. So
it's so when I first hit on, I didn't know it till I was doing my research. You know, because I met you and you, I always, you know, you're always in a suit. You know, you're always so. And I was like, that guy?
Sure.
Not that I don't think you could hold your own in a fight, but you just don't seem like a violent person.
There was definitely a phase where I was very lost. So after high school, I didn't really excel in academia nor athletics. So I went to school in New York to study finance because I guess that's what you do, right?
Right. Where was this?
Here in New York, Manhattan. I went to Baruch College.
Okay.
Yes.
Sure.
And to business school, but I knew that was not necessarily my thing, right? So I wasn't going to classes. I was cutting a lot of classes. And instead, I was going to bars all the time. I was getting, there was one specific nightclub. It was a Korean nightclub called Camel.
Okay.
And I would go there, you know, 4 times a week, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And then Sunday, I'll get a comp table. So it was I was a big into that kind of club scene-esque things.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was, and we would get drunk. And there were a lot of people from different parts of the New York City all coming in to party, and for some reason they would always just pick on me. You know, I'm not sure what it is. So anytime somebody tried to actually kind of instigate, I was never shy to instigate right back. So, you know, I think during that time, I was very physical. I was very, very physical. I think I'll get into like 2-3 bar fights a week.
But was that the way you're describing it? See, I thought it was almost like you went out with the intention of that happening.
I don't think so. I think it was genuinely, back then, again, I was pretty lost. So meeting girls and having a good time, and when what do you do when and that same thing with everybody else, right? Everybody's right. Doing the same thing.
Right. So there's all that energy in the there's a lot of energy in the air.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also I think part of that is also the Korean American or Korean culture, Koreans in America. So I feel like they're almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So I feel like there were whole lot more suppressed in their own daily lives, whatever,
right.
College or work or whatnot.
Yeah.
So I think everyone was a lot more angry, you know? So
right.
On weekends when they want to de-steam, they all kind of came with a little bit of a lot more steam than I see them now, you know?
Right.
I think everyone was really charged up. And I don't think it was just me that was getting into fights. I think in general, there was a lot of beef, if you will.
Yeah, well, there's a reason we have a term bar fight, right? I mean, there's not many other types of, when people talk, you don't hear like office brawl.
Right.
You know, there's not that phrase.
And I think that was I always had this kind of, anytime somebody wanted to bully me, I feel like I just couldn't stand that. And as a younger, because I was a college student and I was obviously younger than the majority of the people that was coming there. So they wanted to kind of like, let it be known that they're older and they're mature. They're kind of in certain mm-hmm. positions. And I basically didn't want to accept that.
Yeah.
And I think they try to then kind of instigate. And at that point, I'll get physical.
And you would just shut it down.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's funny, right? The hospitality guy who used to be a big bar fight.
Well, no, it was just such a, because again, whenever I see you, you just seem so, I mean, I would actually say one other thing, I hadn't thought about this, but you do project, among other things, you do project a sense of someone who's very much in control.
Thank you.
That's something I think feel like you exude, as I've seen you in the few places I've seen you, right? So it doesn't, you would seem to me like someone who could de-escalate a situation, not who would go right to DEFCON 1. You know what I mean?
I definitely agree with you at this point. I feel like I think I can diffuse a lot of situations right now, especially having worked in hospitality for so long.
Yeah.
But I feel like those kind of adolescent times have really trained me, right?
Yeah.
So there's very little thing that really faze me at this point.
Right.
But back then when I was 19, 21, I feel like, a lot of small stimulation have a very big resonance on
mm-hmm.
you. But right now, I feel like, two kids and two restaurants later,
yeah.
I feel like I've found my zen.
Yeah. I want to talk about how you got to Vegas. But I have a question which maybe would lead to that. You just used the word lost about yourself, right?
Sure.
As a young man or someone in their early 20s. Until I did my research on you, I just always assumed you had come to this world of hospitality from a business background.
Sure.
You, if you don't mind me saying, you dress very sharp.
Thank you.
You're a very sharp dresser.
Oh, thank you, Andrew.
You clearly, your restaurant's beautiful. You clearly have, as people say, like an appreciation for finer things. It seems to me. Is that accurate?
Sure. Definitely.
So my question is, you mentioned you went to business school because you didn't know what else to do. And it's interesting to me that you chose business school because, I guess what I'm wondering is, you describe it in very positive terms, but you describe a fairly tumultuous teenage period, right? Like you came to another country.
Sure.
You had to learn the language. You had to assimilate. You didn't really know what you were going to do. But in this country, people, you go to college, people want to know when you start. What's your major? They want to know who knows what their path is. But did you know that you wanted to, did you have an appetite for some kind of success? Did you have an appetite for some kind of, did you have an ambition even though you didn't attach it to anything yet, did you have a sense that you wanted to do something big? I guess that's how I would put the question. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think the ambition always, I always had ambition. When I was younger, I didn't know what that was. But I feel like I was very competitive, but I didn't really have a real platform to be competitive.
Right, because you said you didn't like academics and you didn't excel at sports.
Right.
Yeah.
Because when I was studying, it just never really resonated. It's like you make me take a test, but you hold answers in your hand. To me, that just kind of didn't, you know, it didn't seem so important to me, right? It's like basically, yeah. So when I realized that aspect, right, like you have the answer, you basically put me to kind of scrutiny of learning and going through. For some reason, that really didn't click, you know?
Yeah.
And as far as sports, I didn't really get a chance to play a lot of sports. You know, I never really kind of picked up. So that kind of pent up competitiveness never really shined. And I guess that has a lot to do with me getting into a lot of fights, right? Like if somebody wanted to be competitive in bars and more of an alpha-ness or whatnot, I just didn't take that well, right? Because I didn't have any other you know, outlet, if you will. And then, and both my brother and sister were in art. So I think I decided that I wanted to make, I wanted to be rich, right? I wanted to bring financial because, you know, I knew art is not necessarily a path to making a lot of money, if you will. Not that restaurant is, if you will, in a conventional sense.
Right.
But I think ambition is something that I've always had.
But you just didn't know how to direct it yet.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So that had, you know, it's funny, I not to overgeneralize, but, you know, usually I interview chefs on the show, right?
Sure.
And a lot of these people, as you did not particularly feel motivated or interested in classroom schooling, right? That's a very common thing among people who end up in kitchens, right? A lot of them, though, are highly intelligent, right?
Sure.
And I've always said it, I find it so poignant because I think the dynamic until they figure out what they wanted to do is to have someone who has an innate intelligence but is being made to feel unintelligent by
sure.
convention. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
I feel like that applied to you a little bit. Like you had ambition, you were competitive, you had these instincts, but they weren't tethered to anything.
Sure.
And was that hard? Did you even know that's what was going on with you at the time? I feel like that's something that would be more clear looking back at it than it would be living in it.
Absolutely. I think, Andrew, you just hit the nail on the head. I think growing up, it was just more pent up. You didn't necessarily, on hindsight, I definitely see it.
It all makes sense now.
It does all make sense, right? Because it's not natural for, you know, kids to, you know, get that physical, you know?
Yeah.
It's, looking back, everything makes sense, right?
Yes.
And also, when I found out my purpose, that restaurant is what I wanted to do, it also kind of explains how the velocity and kind of the potential energy that turning into kinetic energy,
yes.
that was definitely visible. So on a hindsight, definitely explains for sure. Because initially, at growing up, again, my father loving food. I naturally loved food. I grew up watching Discovery Channel, you know, the cooking, the French cooking techniques and what have you. So at some point, I wanted to actually become a chef. I think that's kind of...
Interesting.
Yeah. I haven't shared this with any this first time sharing it, but I wanted to be a chef. And I still love cooking because being able to play with different elements and putting that together is... wildly thrilling.
Wow. How did you start along on that path at all? Did you work in a kitchen? Did you take any classes? Did you?
No.
No. So, but it was a thought you had.
Yeah. So in college, I went to business school for 3 years, and then I decided to transfer. That's when I had to make a decision, right? Whether I can go front of the house or actually go into culinary school. And at that point, the decision was based on, and I was serious about going to culinary school, but I guess I wanted to be in business. On a hindsight, that the fact that I went to business school, to Baruch, it kind of comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, I was a little lost, but I feel like intuitively, I kind of knew that I wanted to be in a business world. Mm-hmm. And
so what brings you to Vegas?
Third year in, I knew this wasn't it. And also, it actually, the bar fight aspect actually comes into big play. So again, I was a big knucklehead, and there was another like famous knucklehead, right?
Famous?
Yeah. I was kind of famous, and there was another guy that was famous. And past 3 years, we've been running into each other. We kind of avoided going ahead.
You're talking about famous for bar brawls.
Exactly. And we kind of avoided each other, even though there were many incidents where we kind of went head to head. I knew that if I fight him, it's not going to be pretty. And he knew that if he fought me, it's not going to be pretty. So we kind of like de-escalated in many situations. And then 3 years in, I actually got into altercation with him.
Yeah.
And I got my ass handed. You know, I actually got hospitalized. I almost lost my sight on my right eye.
Wow.
And the other kids
got... Did you have like a detached retina or something like that?
So I got punched so hard, my eyes swelled so high, and blood actually filled kind of a vital eye organ.
Oh, my gosh.
So the doctor was, if the swelling and if your body functions well, then it can go down and you might be fine. But if it doesn't, you do have a chance of losing your sight.
Wow. Is your vision impacted from that to this day, or did you fully recover?
Fully recovered.
Wow, it's great to be young, right?
Exactly.
Wow.
And those kids got arrested, and you know, district attorney got involved. You know, it got into a really big thing. But that's what I knew. Like, what am I doing with my life, right? This is not, you know, waking up in an emergency room.
That was like rock bottom for you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's when I knew I had to leave the situation, right? Because, you know, my friends and, you know, just kind of the environment was not necessarily constructive. So that's when I said, you know what? Like, I gotta wake up. So I put in two transfer applications, one to Cornell and one to UNLV, because I knew I wanted to do hospitality.
Okay.
And I got accepted to UNLV, so I took a one-way flight to Las Vegas. So it's like leaving NYC.
So you go to Vegas. Had you been there ever before you went?
Never.
Never?
Yeah.
Okay, so what? Tell me about arriving there.
So I arrived there, and before leaving, I had my like family friend, who I have never met, arrange something, you know. So I arrived. She picked me up from the airport. And it was a family, and I stayed at her house for 2 weeks, and bought my first car. I didn't have a driver's license. I got my driver's license, and rented my first apartment. And basically started living there.
What year are we talking, roughly?
I think this was 2006.
And not all that long ago.
Not all that long ago, just 14 years ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't even know where to start. I mean, I know a lot of chefs, obviously. You know, a lot of people have moved to Vegas in the last 20 years from New York.
Sure.
I've visited Vegas a ton. But, you know, going there as a young man, entering the hospitality realm, having never been there before, at a time when that's the city is like popping, right? Like there's all these named chefs floating in there. There's the entertainment thing is having a total renaissance.
I think that's exactly when the movement from gambling revenue was getting eclipsed by entertainment and restaurant revenue. Like when I arrived, so that was that. Genuinely and profoundly the renaissance of F&B and entertainment in Las Vegas.
And you could feel that even as a student at UNLV.
Understatement, though. Energy and the big name chefs from New York coming, all over the world coming, and just the energy and the nightclubs and was just completely alluring and overpowering.
I know you got a job at a hotel. What hotel was it?
MGM Grand.
Okay. And was that just to make money, or was that part of your schooling?
Definitely more about, I wanted to get experience. So I went to school for hotel management, so not necessarily F&B. So growing up, my father in Korea, all back then in 90s, all fine dining restaurants, the majority of fine dining restaurants in Seoul were located inside of large hotels. Like, because Korea was a developing nation back then, right? So like, Grand Hyatts, Hilton, and this Korean brand called Shilla, and those kind of large hotels were the only place that had fine dining restaurants. So naturally, I would frequent those places with my father and had this kind of grand affinity towards this beautiful hotel with fine dining restaurants.
Yes.
So I wanted to kind of get back into the allure that I had young age. So that's why I went to hotel school. And so while going there, it makes sense, right? So mm-hmm. if you're in Las Vegas, the best thing that you can do is find a job. So my first real job, other than my parents' restaurant that I worked for when I was a teenager, was my first job was at MGM Grand in front desk.
Your parents' restaurant?
Yes. My parents, when they came over to the States, when my mother actually came with me to the States and settled in Manhasset, my mother and father thought, my father stayed in Korea. He had business there. So yeah. my mother thought that, you know, they need a source of income here in the States. So they invested in a restaurant opening in Tribeca. And then one thing lead to another. The supposed operator actually didn't work out.
Okay.
So my mother is stuck with the lease, you know, 10-year lease, I think 15-year lease. So my mother had a choice of basically defaulting and paying all those things or be the typical my mom, she is. So she said, you know what? Fuck this. I'm going to go in and cook because we had 32 seats in that restaurant. And my extended family, when she first married my father, was 32 people. So my mother would cook for 32 of my family members in this, you know, my father's house, you know.
Wow.
So naturally, my mother took upon the challenge, and I was 16 years old. So I would actually come out, because it was kind of cool, you know, to work in a restaurant in Manhattan, in Tribeca.
Of course. Yeah.
So I started as a busboy, kind of... seeing how what that's like. And I remember as a night before opening, I'm like, how is my mom from South Korea that speaks, you know, like she speaks decent English, but she's not an American, you know, she doesn't have any base. How is she going to open up a restaurant in Tribeca? You know, back then it was the coolest place, you know?
Yeah.
So I was concerned, but like she opened it and it was very successful. So I think that's when I kind of got this.
The bug.
The bug and the courage, right?
If
my mom, middle-aged mom from South Korea, can do this in Tribeca, why wouldn't I be able to do it? You know?
Wow. So, what was the name of the restaurant?
Sure. The name of the restaurant was Kori.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And did you find that I mean, you described yourself as a kid, you know, entertaining at the table and helping your mom serve. Mm-hmm. Did you find that you had a natural aptitude for what you were doing there? Like, did you have... I feel like, you know, like tennis players talk about having a court sense.
Sure.
I feel like people who are born to be in hospitality have like a dining room sense.
Sure.
They kind of have a sense of the rhythm of the room. They can spot a table that needs something.
Sure.
They have that kind of sixth sense. Do you know what I'm describing?
Absolutely.
Did you have that or the
Absolutely.
Beginnings of that?
I
were you wired that way?
Yeah. I can't actually recall. I mean, but I definitely had the seed for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, I was that since I was like 4 years old, right? Older brother and my father, who was introvert, and my mother and I kind of tossing back and forth in the kitchen to make people happy. And if my brother was not talking, I would strike a conversation to always just kind of bring people together, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, I strongly believe that food brings people together. You add on hospitality to it, you know, actual conscious effort to bring people together through food. Now you have a pretty sure shot way of a family coming together.
Mm.
And I think, you know, having that experience as a growing up, almost as a toddler, I think I learned that very, very quickly.
You work in the hotel, and tell me about that experience. It seems to me, at least from what I've read, that you... quickly found satisfaction, I guess I would call it, in guest satisfaction.
Absolutely. It was really exciting. I mean, before I worked at my mother's 32-seat restaurant in Tribeca, and before that, you know, I don't think I actually knew what it's like to be in a real world, and if that real world is, you know, part of 4,044 room, once the largest hotel in the world, you know, so, and... You know, where does it all begin? It begins in the front desk, right? You check in, and from then on, everything happens, right? So as a 25-year-old, I think it was a really, really exciting time.
As I understand it, you quickly showed an aptitude for resolving complaints, problems.
Sure.
Yeah, is that accurate?
Absolutely. So even as I just began, and I was young, one of the younger ones, and I was one of the most more inexperienced ones. But I actually genuinely enjoyed those challenges. You know, like you would imagine, right? If you're a front desk agent that gets paid hourly rate, you know, why would you want to deal with, you know, issues that are really difficult, right? But I really enjoyed it. You know, I always raise my hand. You know, let me deal with it.
Give me the ball.
And because I was just genuinely passionate about this.
You know,
I wanted to please. I think it's inside of me. I think it's in my blood. I really want to please people.
Now, this is one of those things that sounds like a cliche, right? Mm-hmm. When you talk about hospitality people, right? They're people pleasers, right? But it's not that. It's true.
It really is.
And it's not that complicated, really. Some people do take great pleasure in providing whatever you want to call it, comfort, hospitality, welcoming, whatever.
It's like this. Like, when I'm in a room, and if I'm going to be in this room, and the person next to me is unhappy, this bad juju, it's just bad vibe. You know, if I'm going to be in this room, might as well go strike a conversation and make that person happy. And now I can be happy and he's happy. So a lot of people may ask, like, but why do you need to do that? You know, why doesn't he, shouldn't he? Like, why do you?
Right.
I don't ask that question. It's like, A, it's not so much effort. I mean, now that I got two kids in a restaurant, I have a little less energy, I guess, to spare.
Yeah.
But as a single man or growing up, it was a no-brainer. Why not, right? Why have a chance of having negative energy in the room when you actually have a talent and, you know, it's not that difficult. You just strike a conversation, say a few nice things, boom, that's it, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I saw the same thing with irate guest, you know. Irate guest would come, and Andrew, in that hotel, literally I've seen everything, you know. 4,044 rooms in Las Vegas. On slow nights, the cheapest room be $89 a night. On most expensive night, the same room that I was selling at $89.99 would cost like $599 for boxing fight night. So you can imagine and from gamblers to Californians to, I've seen it all.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Like, I mean, and the thing about Vegas that, and I don't know what, you know, I assume you probably worked a variety of different shifts, right? But the thing about Vegas, unless you've spent time in Vegas, you can't fully even understand when people say this. That's a 24-hour city. And in the big hotels are like 24-hour, like, microcosms or biospheres almost. You know, I remember once being in LA, in Vegas, and I was going to leave for L.A. in the morning by car. But I had to be in there in time for a lunch, right? So I was leaving at like 5 in the morning. And I remember coming down the elevator, it was at the Cosmopolitan, another huge hotel.
Yes.
I was on the 55th floor, I think. Mm-hmm. And coming down to the elevator at 5 a.m., and I remember the doors opening, and I could smell the cigarette smoke from the little bank of machines that was right next to the receptionist area, or the reception area, the check-in area.
Sure.
At 5 a.m. on like a Wednesday morning.
Never stops.
It never stops. And I think unless you've lived there or spent real time there, you don't get that. But
I don't think so.
And it's very, I think it's unique in this. I don't think there's another place really like that in this country. I mean,
Definitely not.
This is the city that never sleeps, but New York sleeps.
New York definitely. I mean, coming from Las Vegas, anyone says New York is a city that never sleeps, I'm like, yeah. Las Vegas definitely does not sleep.
So what was it that kind of spun you from, you said you went to the school for hotel management.
Sure.
What spun you from hotels into a desire to be a restaurateur?
Sure. So I was in front desk and I was really passionate about it because I feel like when I was part of that organization, it was really exciting. You know, we talked about kind of that competitive edge and competitive energy that always had. really kind of sparked, right? Because we had like 200 front desk agents. I really wanted to excel. And I quickly became a manager there, assistant manager front desk. And I was in the front desk. So where is it located? That's where everyone comes comes through. So whether you're a casino host, whether you're a Cirque du Soleil dancer, whether you're custodian, doesn't matter. I would always just say hello. You know, hello, Andrew. Goodbye, Andrew. You know, that was just my thing. You know, why not? Because that was, I think, one of my superpower is saying hello and saying goodbye. And one day, vice president of fine dining just came to me and said, hey, Simon, do you like restaurant? Do you like working at restaurants? And I was like, sure, you know, absolutely. My parents owned a restaurant, blah, blah, blah. It's like, do you want to come and manage a Japanese restaurant in MGM, you know? And I was like, let me think about it. And that was 3 years into front desk. I was like, fuck yes. And that was the beginning.
Now, what level were you at the front desk at that point? Had you risen to some kind of managerial level?
Yes. Or? So I was a front desk manager.
Manager. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you were the, when someone says, I want to see a supervisor, that was you.
Yes.
So you got all the worst of it.
Definitely the worst of it, yes. And front desk is really exciting and not exciting to many people because anytime you have a problem with anything, right?
Yes.
Whether you find something on the bed, whether something is soiled, something is not happy, who do you call? You call the front desk, you know? So I literally dealt with, you know, hair in the bed to dirty sink to clog to toilets to, that was kind of like basically everything funneled through guest services or front desk.
Sure.
So I think after 3 years, I was like, and when somebody mentioned restaurant, I think I was ready to make the change.
This person must have been deeply impressed by you to say, do you want to all of a sudden manage a restaurant?
I actually don't know what he saw in me. I guess I said hello in a very gracious manner.
They throw you in there. That must have been a crash course for you.
There was a crash course, but I think that I think it was in me, right? That hospitality and F&B was really in me. You know, I think my father, my mother, going to fine dining restaurants and that environment really kind of trained me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thrown into a crash course, but I feel like I maneuvered and finished the race in a record time.
Okay. And what style, you said Japanese restaurant, was it like a sushi restaurant? Was it a Japanese, what was the style of food?
It was kind of Japanese fine dining.
Okay.
We had about 300 sake labels, along with a sake sommelier.
Mm-hmm.
Very high end. We had half, like the one third of the restaurant was hibachi grill, kind of very, very high-end Benihana style, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So we had Japanese Wagyu, American Wagyu, with like Australian spiny lobsters to on one section. And the other section was sushi and sashimi. I was there for about a year and a half.
I'm going to make an assumption that you liked at least the experience of running a restaurant.
I think that's an understatement. I think I enjoyed front desk. I really felt like, you know, being on the floor of a restaurant, I felt like fish finally meeting water.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, now what, I mean, was it an adrenaline thing? Is it the customer, you talked about the saying hello and goodbye, right? Was it the customer interaction? Was it just the whole package just felt like where you belonged? Can you even put words to it?
Absolutely. The euphoria that I felt.
That's a big word.
Yes. I think I'm addicted to it. People being happy. I think it really kind of excites me, you know. Front desk was definitely rewarding, right? But F&B is completely different, you know.
Yeah.
Think about it. Like, people come in, and then I have less than 2 hours, right? That's all you get.
Yeah.
You know, at front desk, you get like 4 or 5 days, you know, if not weeks, you know, to see whether that, you know, that kind of interaction was successful or not. Right.
Whereas, and you have more time to correct something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also, oftentimes, you kind of don't know, right? You check people in and they enjoy it, they check out, and that's the end of it, right? Whereas, restaurant, that person's in your front of you for, you know, whether it's hour to 3 hours in front of you, and there's that instant gratification, right?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody comes hungry, somebody's a little frustrated, or somebody lost money, somebody just broke up with whatever that is, somebody's just really hangry. That person comes in, and then you just kind of, you know, put on that show, right? You give them hospitality, you give them the first drink, you give them the beautiful plate of sashimi, sushi plate, and then dessert, and then boom. And guests are like, oh my God, that was so freaking awesome. And that person leaves, and then it starts all over again. And that kind of, you know, if kind of putting that business school back in, if working in front desk was a long-term investment, the restaurant is kind of day trading, right? Mm. Like you can actually make like instant returns.
Yeah.
And it also doesn't suck. Instead of talking about, you know, what we're talking about is all exciting things like Japanese Wagyu. You want to have Daiginjo sake.
Right.
It was really
You're not
exciting.
Just talking about the fact that somebody wanted, you know, no feather pillows in their room. And right.
Right. And, yeah. then when people make that purchase, it's not like...
Or the toilet overflowed or...
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
But even aside from front desk, let's say a cell phone, right? Like you buy the cell phone, person leave with the cell phone, and then that person is going to use that cell phone and like... And then... But you don't see that, right? Whereas in restaurant, this all happens. Like you recommend something, that person eats it right there and then.
Yeah.
And if you hit it right, that person's immediately happy. And that person actually thanks you for your recommendation, right? And that kind of instant gratification, I think, is nothing short of addicting.
Mm, mm. I love that. I feel like I don't think I've ever thought about it in these terms. But as you're talking about what you do, it strikes me, I feel like... There's a trait that comes into play if you're going to be really great at what you do, right? And I feel like that trait is empathy. I feel like there's the ability to read a table or read a guest quickly.
Sure.
To have a sense. I talk about this with interviews. You know, when young writers ask me about interviewing, I always say, if you can do it in person, do it in person. And I always say when you meet with someone, you have 5 seconds
sure.
to understand, are they having a good day or a bad day? Do they want to be there or not?
Sure.
Are they open or not? Are they trusting or not? And that's all something I feel like you either have the ability to just sense that energy from someone or not. Does it
sure.
make sense?
Absolutely.
But that's something that's a real skill in your line of work, the ability to intuit what's going on with it's a couple having a fight, you know,
sure.
like so, there are cues.
There are definitely cues. And that intuition, I think, honestly, if there are people who's tuning in who are aspiring to be a restaurateur, I think that intuition is, you know, A, I think there's some innate thing, right? But B, I think you really can build on this, right? You need to really kind of train. And I feel like I did that very young age. You know, again, I had 2 older siblings and a father, so I always had to kind of gauge their moods and be able to kind of respond accordingly, you know, as a yes. tag team with my mother.
Yeah.
So I think that has really kind of trained me to it. And that Las Vegas experience really kind of allowed me to explode in that sense.
Hmm.
Part of the reason why I felt like I felt like it was fish meeting the water in Vegas is that, so I'm the junior manager, I'm the newest manager there, so everyone is kind of not sure what this guy can do, right? He's a very little experience, but I literally like killed it. You know, I totally killed it. What I mean by that is, so I observed for about a month, you know, what's happening in this restaurant. And I realized that there are, you know, people from California that came for the weekend, they just want to eat, you know, a few rolls and a Sapporo and hang out, you know?
Yeah.
And then there are people who came from, like, China who was, like, big-time gamblers, right? Or any... I just realized that gamblers would spend so much more in a restaurant. And it was very simple why they were doing that. Because they had comps, you know? So when you gamble $100,000, you probably get, like, $5,000 to spend anywhere you want. So when they would come, they would spend like $4,000 for a dinner for 4. They would just buy whatever they want to buy because it was comp. But as far as the restaurant is concerned, it was a revenue, you know, same dollar. So I think once I realized that, I also have an Asian background, so I really knew how to take care of them, you know, just give them the attention, just give them the kind of, treat them like a VIP, you know, the gamblers and the high rollers.
Now, what do you mean when you say you, because you had an Asian background, what's the connection there?
Sure. So majority of those big time gamblers were Asian descent. And I'm obviously Korean American, right? So I kind of knew how to treat them with, meet their expectation, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm spending $4,000 on a dinner, you know, I want to be treated a certain way. And kind of, my father was never that kind of rambunctious or like, you know, he was always prudent with his luxurious lifestyle, but these guys weren't, right? But like how my father wanted to be treated,
yeah,
right, which is with respect and attention to detail, and you know, he didn't want any hot tea being cold, right?
Yes.
Like, you know, like if it's cold, even though it's not done, replenish it with hot water. So
yes.
It's always cold.
Yeah.
I'm always hot. So things like that, you know, so nuanced things like that, I really kind of paid attention. And before you know it, I was pulling in like one third of revenue of $10 million restaurant by just, you know, in the afternoon, I'll call my Far East casino marketing and say, hi, Tony, this is Simon from this restaurant. If you send your guests, I'll put them in a private room, take great care of them. And that's all they needed to hear, because it didn't really matter.
Right.
And then before you know it, everyone in casino marketing was like, send your guests to Simon, because Simon always takes care of them. And I think that was when I kind of really realized, you know, take care of your coworkers, environment around you, and they will be able to really kind of help you flourish.
Right. And you relished that response. Like when they would send someone your way, you relished that.
Absolutely. You know, they trust me to
yes.
take care of their very high valued guest.
Yeah.
And I definitely didn't want to drop the ball, you know, that competitive
yeah.
edge. I wanted to make sure that,
yeah.
Yeah.
It finally had an outlet.
Exactly.
So can I ask you, this is a bit of a tangent, but you just said something, and it echoes something I've heard from a number of people I've interviewed, and also just friends of mine in conversation. Huni is someone who did it. You just referenced, you said, because I'm Asian. Now, as a Caucasian, right, mm-hmm. If I were to speak very broadly and refer to Asian people, right, mm-hmm. that's considered now horribly out of touch.
Sure.
Right? To not be more specific.
Sure.
I've noticed that a lot of people from Asian countries who come to the United States do tend to very often group themselves as more broadly Asian. Does this mm-hmm. question make sense?
Sure.
I'm just wondering, for you, what it is that that you don't specifically say Korean when you said mm-hmm. that. Does that question make sense?
Sure.
It strikes me, because it's not the I've noticed it many times in conversation.
I think that's a great, interesting question, because obviously we as Asians see ourselves in a very specific manner. You know, I'm Korean.
Yes.
And my grandfather has a heritage in North Korea, so it seems like it gets more granulated and granulated. Right?
Yes, right.
But that being said, growing up, I think I can very confidently say I was labeled as an Asian.
When you came here?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Now it's a little different, obviously, but growing up and being in Las Vegas or even in New York, I feel like, you know, no one really was interested whether I was Korean from what descent. It was more like, you're an Asian American, you know?
Got it. And by the same, is this a fair assumption? By the same token, there's a certain solidarity that comes in the United States. You're Korean, but you have a certain solidarity with someone who's from Japan or someone who's from China. Or is that accurate?
In terms of the
immigrant experience here.
Sure. I mean, but I don't think it's as, I mean, I think it's very similar. It's not just immigrant. I think all husbands all have a similar thing, right?
Right.
All women have a similar thing, right?
Yeah.
So definitely Asian people have that kind of, just like husband and wives and whatnot, we have our own kind of camaraderie and solidarity.
Yes.
But we also have a lot of differences where, you know, different, you know, hard feelings for historical things and whatnot.
Of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Was that all? You understood what I was asking. Yeah,
sure.
It strikes me, because you're not the first person who's spoken of it in those terms.
Because I think it's interesting, because, Andrew, when, like, platform like this is obviously very nuanced, right? And it's culture and nuance of culture is very much important in this kind of conversations,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, very.
But that being said, you know, everyday life, you know, I feel like Asian person is very much viewed as an Asian person, mm-hmm. you know, like in, even in our neighborhood, right? On 8th floor, there's an Asian guy, right? You know, like, right. there's that. I think even in New York City.
Even in New York.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even in New York City, the most, you know, one of the most sophisticated
cities. One of the most worldly American cities.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
So, New York.
Yeah, New York.
What brings you back? And what's the road to Peoria?
Yeah. So, what brings me back to New York is New York, in my humble opinion, is the best city in the world. And I say this even after COVID-19, you know? I see...
Well, can I just interrupt and say, yes, COVID-19, but, you know, a few months after this horror show that you were describing a few minutes ago.
Sure.
We're sitting out here on a beautiful afternoon at your restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You're luckier than some.
Sure.
Luck's not maybe the right word, but you know, you made it through. Not everybody has.
Sure.
But the city is starting to feel like the city that you and I both came to and love.
Right.
Yeah.
And what I love about New York and the reason why it's so important for me to be here in New York is, you know, if you go to Tokyo, I think Tokyo has better, like in terms of total quality, better food than New York by far. If you go to Paris, I think you will have much better French food than here in New York, you know. Or if you go to even in Korea, and I run a Korean steakhouse, but I think you can find better meat-centric Korean restaurant in Korea.
Okay.
I guess what I'm leading up to is, but nowhere in this world you will find the diversity that coexists with the sense of excellence. You know, I can go to Chinatown, I can go to Little Tokyo, I can go to Little Brazil, Little Italy. You know, and all really kind of have that. It's not some like, you know, really diluted version of things, right?
Tourist like, trap.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I think
yeah.
that's, you know, having been in food business for a while and traveling around the world focusing on food, the single most important aspect of NYC dining is that kind of the diversity along with sense of excellence, you know? And I kind of compare it to like the most beautiful coral reef, if you will.
How so?
It's like the ecosystem, right? There's beautiful, beautiful and expansive ecosystem. You know, there's small mom and pop restaurants, you know, in Lower East Side. And there are such a like grandiose, you know, restaurants in Midtown, like, you know, 3 Michelin star restaurants. And that kind of diverse ecosystem kind of reminds me of this beautiful, colorful and exciting and diverse coral reef. You know, so many different creatures, all kind of... one is not better than the other. You know, 3 Michelin star restaurant is not better than the mom and pop restaurants. They're just different, and it all coexists in a very respectful and symbiotic relationship. And to me, you know, ever since I saw that, you know, even my mom's restaurant, you know, the small mom and pop restaurant was not necessarily less important than the other restaurant. So, so when I knew it was my calling to do a restaurant, I wanted to open a restaurant no other place than New York.
Mm, okay. So you come back.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the genesis of Peoria?
Peoria, so I had a good fortune of working some of the most amazing chefs. You know, I worked for Jean-Georges, worked for Chef Thomas Keller, BR Guest Restaurants, Steve Hansen's Empire. And having worked there, I wanted to pursue more, right? Like, how do I actually touch the magic, you know? So when I came back to New York, I worked for Bluefin in Times Square. It's W. It's very, like, 350-seat restaurant.
That's a BR Guest restaurant.
Correct.
Yep.
And it was really bustling, and it really kind of trained me to New York's hustle and, like, you know, the volume and the hustle and bustle. And then I wanted to pursue something that's a little more magical, and that's when I had fortune to a good fortune of working for Jean-Georges.
Mm-hmm.
And his restaurants are fantastic. There's a lot of magic there.
Which restaurants did you work at?
It's ironic. The first Jean-Georges restaurant that I started to work for was at Matsugen.
Mm-hmm.
It's his Japanese restaurant on Church Street between Church and Leonard.
Mm-hmm.
And funny thing is, my mother's restaurant, Corey, was located literally half a block on the same block. So I remember as a 16-year-old, when that's when it wasn't Matsugen. It was 66, his Chinese restaurant.
Sure.
Yeah, when it was being built.
Josh Sharkey was the chef there.
That's right.
Yeah.
And my mother was, I remember my mother saying, pointing at that restaurant, it's a 3 Michelin star chef. He's opening a restaurant there. And I remember kind of looking through the glasses, you know, the fancy restaurant. And fast forward 7-8 years, I was managing that restaurant.
So
it was
so funny.
It was really exciting. And then we closed that restaurant. That's when Japanese earthquake took place, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the Japan team, who were a partnership, decided to go back to Japan. So that's when we closed the restaurant, and I got moved to Mark Hotel in Upper East Side, which was very much of an eye-opening experience. And that was a fantastic experience. But during that time, I knew it was my time to open my own restaurant. And from then on, I started to speak to very close personal family friends and some of my customers and whatnot, and basically started raising capital.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a brief job at a bakery, Bouchon Bakery.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when I kind of finalized my plans and things and found the lease.
Great. You said Bouchon Bakery, but you mean Bouchon, you were at the restaurant Bouchon, the Time Warner restaurant?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, okay. Was the process of raising capital comfortable for you, having gone to, you know, business school and...
No, I think honestly, probably raising capital is the most difficult thing, because you're using the muscles that you never used. You know, I was very well versed in pleasing people, you know, how to make you happy as a diner. I was very good with even culinary aspects, right? I had some chops. But how do you actually ask someone to cut your check, you know, the business plans?
You had to become like a salesperson.
Exactly, yeah. Along with creating P&Ls and projections and all those good stuff. And honestly, I think that was the most, you know, to date, I think raising capital is always kind of most difficult, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, that seems a lot natural to me, because if you just look at the hard numbers, most restaurants don't last. I mean... You are asking people to take quite a leap.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it's funny, right? So they say statistically, you know, 9 out of 10 restaurants fail, right? I'm not sure how true that is. But restaurants are definitely very well known as a very risky business, right? Mm-hmm. We all know it, right? We don't need to know what the exact percentage, right? Because percentage all differ by cities and cuisine. And so without getting into details, everyone already knows that restaurant is a very risky venture. What's really important is, let's make believe 9 out of 10 restaurants fail, right? I feel like, with all due respect, right, in a very practical sense, I think 5 out of 10 restaurants really shouldn't have started, right? This is, you know, someone who likes food, you know what I mean? Like, you see where I'm going with this, right?
It's not something to be dabbled in or taken lightly.
Exactly.
Yes.
It's not like...
And some people get kind of... I'm sorry, I don't mean it, but since you asked me if I'm understanding what you're saying, it's some people just get caught up in this notion of, oh, it'd be nice, you know, like they say in Citizen Kane, it'd be nice to own a newspaper. You know, they think, oh, it'd be fun to own a restaurant, with absolutely no sense of the commitment and expertise and... to use a word of one of your old employers, finesse, that is required to do it successfully.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times people retire, right, after working, you know, 30 years in one thing and say, gee, what am I going to do? And, oh, you know, my friends always told me that my pasta sauce was fantastic.
Yeah.
Why don't I open up a red sauce joint, you know? You know, I don't speak for all other cities, but I feel like, especially now more than ever, restaurants are such a competitive industry, you know, our industry. So I feel like, you know, 5 out of 10 restaurants kind of, you know, with all due respect, was kind of a wrong decision, you know, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I think then if you leave out, if you focus on the other 5, now that we narrow down to 5, I think 2.5 restaurants out of that 5 is underfunded to begin with. You know, people scramble for money, and opening a restaurant is just like any business. It's a real financial venture, right?
Yeah.
So you can't open up a restaurant thinking that I have $500,000, can I open up a restaurant with $500,000, you know? You got to actually really budget everything out and how much runway you have, because, you know, chances of you opening a restaurant and from day one being profitable just doesn't make any sense, you know? So I feel like that's also that. So now you're left with 2.5 restaurants. And amongst that, I do think that 50-50 chance of succeeding or not. And I guess that leaves to, 1.75% of a...
There you go. You know, wow, look at the math. 10, wow, yeah. That's pretty fast. Yeah, that's great. I love that point of view. I love that point of view. Still, I have to say, if I'm being honest, 50-50, if you did everything else right, that's still, those are still long odds.
Sure.
So what was the concept for Peora? You know, the thing that strikes me, this restaurant that we're sitting outside is such a... if you don't mind me saying it, it's such a successful... I'm not talking about financial success. To me, and obviously I'm not alone, it is just such a successful restaurant. The style of it, the quality of it, the vibe of it, the competence. I remember when I interviewed David Shim, and he told me, you know, you guys had this little thing internally, like drinks plus fire... plus meat equals fun,
yeah.
Right?
Meat plus fire plus booze equals
smiles.
Yeah.
Equals, right. Total. I mean, that made so much sense to me. It is a place that, I love coming here. It's one of the places I like to bring my wife to. We were talking before. My son, who, you know, can sometimes lower himself to go to restaurants with me, would find it to be incredibly cool, right? That has to come from something, right?
Sure.
That has to come from a personal place, I believe. I don't think you can come to that by committee. I don't think you can come to that by luck. I think you come to that from someone's vision, right?
Sure.
So going back to Peora, that was your first solo outing, right?
Sure.
What was the vision or the mission with that restaurant as you saw it at the time?
I wanted to create a restaurant, a jewel box of restaurant, West Village. I think any New York restaurateur kind of dreams of opening a restaurant in West Village. Because West Village is stylish. It is not so crowded, right? I think it's very specific clientele, if you will. And in my humble opinion, it's one of the most awesome places to live in New York City. You know, because it's got...
Do you live over there?
I don't. I live in Upper West Side.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Okay.
Very different with two kids.
I know what you mean, though. That is the word I always use about that area. I used to live in Chelsea.
Sure.
But I used to take my dog down to play in a big baseball field right near where your Peora was.
Oh, yes, exactly, literally.
Like in the winter, I don't know if this was going on still when Peora was there, but for years, in the winter when people weren't playing baseball, that was basically a sanctioned dog park in the winter.
Sure.
And there would just be like 50 dogs there on the weekend. And the word I always used about that neighborhood was unspoiled.
Sure.
It felt like one of the few neighborhoods in New York where there wasn't a Gap on every corner, there wasn't a Starbucks on every corner. For people who don't live in New York, where you guys were, it was pretty far west.
Sure.
And not that far north above Tribeca.
That is true.
And that felt, in a lot of ways, it felt like this kind of timeless New York.
100%. See, Andrew, you describe it so eloquently.
That's exactly
how I fell in love. I thought it was quintessential New York without the commercialized and too gentrified, but still very affluent and it's beautiful. People are classy. People, you know, I think it had a really right balance of style and, you know, that uncommercialized aspect. So
yeah.
I kind of dreamt of opening a restaurant there. And I just knew that that's where I was going to open my first restaurant. And I was looking for a chef partner. And when I was looking for a chef, it didn't really matter what cuisine. I didn't have a concept in mind. I wanted to find the chef. Because I knew that between the chef and I, we'll create a partnership and we'll figure it out, right? Like, what's natural to us? You know, it's not outside in, it's inside out. You know? And the name also represented that. You know, Peora. It's actually a Korean word. A lot of people think it's Italian because Peora was Italian-Korean. But pronounced Peora in Korean meaning, Korean definition of Peora is to blossom. So it was, you know, having worked for great chefs and great institutions, it was our opportunity to blossom our own flower.
Oh, That's it. I didn't realize it was a verb. I knew blossom. I thought it was a noun, like a blossom. Yeah. It means to blossom.
Yeah. It's almost like a commanding, like blossom. So I look for chefs, and some of them are Greek American, some of them are Italian American, some of them are French American, some of them are Korean American. And, you know, I did tasting with five different chefs. And my former partner, Chris, he was just an amazing chef. And he was Italian-American, so he had that background, but classically trained. So the idea was that now I found a chef who knew how to cook, who had a traditional culinary background. I wanted to now expose him to my culture. So the idea is, whatever it is, whether it's Greek, Italian, French, I feel like New Yorkers are somewhat very familiar with that cuisine, right? Because New York is a diverse culinary city. And I wanted to add non-westernized, non-gentrified flavors of Korea into that cuisine and basically share that with New Yorkers. So what we did is, as soon as we finalized chef, hi, nice to meet you. It's like, nice to meet you. Let's go to Korea together. And went to Korea for 2 weeks, traveled through the coast, along the coast, and we're eating 7 meals a day. And I still remember, it was so cold. It was like negative, like way, way below freezing. And
literally.
Way, way, way. It's probably the coldest winter that Korea has seen in a long time. And I remember we were just getting a car, drive down 2 hours south, and then eat, and then get in the car, drive 2 hours, eat, and drive 2 hours and eat. And during that time on social media, I would put like, I'm here, where should I go next? And like a lot of my Facebook friends, because in Korea, were like, you should go there, there, there. And then it was a just really fun trip.
Oof.
Yeah. Because eating 8 meals is too many. So 7 meals is where we capped it.
Okay.
And so we were really kind of exposed ourselves to, you know, just down and dirty, true, like, some fine dining, but mostly just real down and dirty flavors of Korea, you know, all different regions. And we came back, and basically the vision was, you know, we're not trying to like claim ourselves as a Korean Italian fusion, because how can you know Korean food after 2 weeks of traveling of Korea, you know? So what we wanted to do is, what was that trip, you know, as an Italian American chef exposed to 2 weeks of that? So it was probably about 80% Asian, 80% Italian-American, like, you know, cuisine, modern American Italian influence with like a hint of Korean flavor.
Yes.
And I think that was the beginning of Piora.
So you guys opened, you very well received, didn't make it though.
No. It was a great run. We first opened, and from the day one, it was actually, you know, it was very busy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very busy, and we're very grateful. Room was always full. For some reason, we couldn't make the numbers work. P&L just didn't work. So profit was really low. In fact, I was losing money. And we got 2 stars in New York Times. Super happy. But for some reason, I just can't make the math work, you know? So it was busy, and I'm losing money. And I, like, in like 8 months of opening, I'm down to zero. So we have literally no money in the bank. But the restaurant's busy. So I go out to meet my friends. They're like, Simon has a beautiful, awesome, bustling restaurant in West Village, fine dining. So the checks are on Simon. You know? But meanwhile, I have a negative account. You know, I literally have no money. So I remember kind of sneaking out without paying, you know? So it was really kind of bad times. And came to conclusion that it's time for us to pull the plug.
Yeah.
You know.
How hard was that? I mean, that was your first one.
But actually, that's the first time around. I actually borrowed like, you know, upwards of $100,000 in personal debt
to keep it going.
Keep it going, because I couldn't let check bounce. Because once the check bounce, that's when it gets ugly. You know. So.
Yeah.
So I started borrowing $20,000 from here, $20,000 from here, $20,000 from here. And then he reached like north of $100,000. Like, what do you do? I have no idea how I'm going to pay these people back at all. I thought it was over. But that's a year and a half into it, and Michelin star was bestowed on Piora.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when things kind of flipped, and it became really profitable. And then fast forward 3 years. So we had a a true uptick. You know, we were making money, we paid all the debt back, and we're kind of like really in a good place. But still, it was a little difficult because we couldn't figure out. The space was just a little too small. We only had, ironically, 32 seats in that restaurant. And we had way too many chefs, and just numbers just didn't work out.
32?
Right? Mm-hmm.
That's that same number.
I know, 32.
Was that intentional?
No.
Wow.
It just came out to be that way. And we couldn't make
that them. Was the number, right, that your mom had cooked for?
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. 32 seat is an important number. Never thought about that, yeah.
Really?
No. I didn't put
you
the
never
two
connected
together.
That?
No.
You should be on the lookout for that number.
I know. Probably third one for the charm, probably. And then we kept the restaurant open for 3 more years, right?
Yeah.
But it was kind of a difficult battle, you know, because once the first phase of a honeymoon phase of Michelin Star was over, you know, it was kind of starting to get kind of a little difficult financially, and it was getting a little more difficult financially. And meanwhile, I was preparing to open Code. And then eventually when I opened Code and I had my wife was pregnant, my chef decided to leave to California. And I think that's when we decided to close PR.
So what was the genesis of this place?
Genesis of Goat is also kind of natural. So I mentioned that Blossom is Piora.
Mm-hmm.
So Goat in Korean definition is flower.
Okay.
So flower comes after the blossoming. So that was that. But Goat is genuinely a true representation of who I am.
Hmm.
You know, here I don't have to fake anything. You know, here I don't have to pretend to be anything other than who I am. What I mean by that is growing up as a Korean American, I wasn't sure what I was.
Because mm-hmm.
when I go to Korea, people look at me and they're like, you're not really Korean, you know, you're like American, you know, because I spoke English and my Korean had a little bit of accent. And in America, obviously, I mentioned you're an Asian person, you know, you're from Korean. So I think I always had to kind of really kind of identity crisis, if you will.
Mm.
And if I go to, and when I started working in fine dining restaurants, it was also a little weird, you know, like, what are you? And I always had to behave in such a sophisticated manner and like in certain fine dining demeanor, if you will. But I was young, you know, I'm still, you know, 38 years old. So when I was set out to design this restaurant, I really wanted to be not shy, you know, really own up to who I am. Yes, I am not necessarily Korean-Korean, nor I'm American-American, but I'm a Korean-American. So this is Korean Steakhouse. Growing up, I loved Korean barbecue because my father took me to fine dining restaurants, which was frankly boring when you're young, but
yeah.
When he took me to Korean barbecue, it was so much fun. There's fire on the table, you know, people are getting a little loud, and they're just like much more lively, if
yes.
you will,
yeah.
you know? What they lacked is a lot of amenities. You know, the fine dining aspect of that really was lacking. So I was like, you know what? Why don't we take what I loved growing up and then pair that with what I learned as an adult, right? Professionally, I learned from, you know, fine dining restaurants how to actually make the service immaculate, wineless, cocktailless, bathroom, music, reservation system, all those things that I learned as a professional. I just basically put the two together.
Well, can I quote your own words back to you? You also, if I understand you accurately, you also, as a proud New Yorker, created there's the Korean and American sides, and then there's the New Yorker.
Sure.
Right? And you described New York restaurant scene as the combination of diversity and excellence. And that's what this is, right?
I
mean, you took this thing that is maybe considered traditionally very casual.
Sure.
You know, you can go up to 32nd Street.
Sure.
And you know, have any number of experiences that are, you know, I mean, technically, I guess, it would be under the same umbrella as what you do here. Much more casual,
sure.
obviously, without all the trappings, right? But you applied your own standards to it.
Sure.
Is that accurate?
Again, dead on, Andrew. You know, that's exactly it. And that diversity, and also what's really interesting is a lot of times people look at what other people are doing and they really want to have that kind of, they want it, you know? And I feel like when you're so vividly impacted with one concept or one restaurateur or one chef, I feel like you can never be, you're trying to be number two of that category, right? Whereas when I found out that the reason why I had identity crisis made me actually the most unique person in that aspect too, right? So when I learned that I no longer was insecure about my identity, actually I was very confident about that unique niche angle of it.
It had value.
Exactly.
You were an original.
Right.
Yeah.
And especially in restaurant business where it's all culture, right? And yeah. Diversity and culture is what really excites people. And I was able to channel true and tested Korean barbecue and true and tested New York steakhouse, which, you know, probably, arguably, you know, I would say one of the most excellent concept in the world, right? New York steakhouses.
Definitely one of the most enduring. Yeah.
For sure. It becomes institutions. And that concept came to my mind and never escaped.
So when you put this place together, you know, it took me a while, to be honest, because it was so successful. You know, it wasn't until I interviewed David that I could get a reservation when I wanted one. But I don't plan that far ahead. That's the problem. But did it meet your expectations right out of the box? Like when you started, did you, like having had one restaurant already under your belt?
Sure.
Did you more or less hit the mark you were looking to hit when you opened? Do you feel, I mean, obviously there's always fine tuning.
Sure.
But do you feel like more or less you kind of opened the restaurant you wanted to open when you first opened it?
Absolutely. I think that's an understatement. I feel like I swung hard, you know, I was looking for a home run for sure. But I think I was looking for, what do you call that? It just base is not loaded. You just hit a home run.
Yeah.
Is what I was going for.
Uh-huh.
When we opened, you know, I humbly and with so much gratefulness, I say that I think it was a grand slam.
You felt great.
Yes.
That's great.
And I felt just so grateful. And especially having closed the restaurant, you know, that's when I closed Peora, which was probably the saddest moment of my life. And that's when my baby was born too, my firstborn. Mm. So there's a lot writing, you know. I'm married, I have a kid, and just closed the restaurant. And if coat didn't really hit, then I kind of don't know what it would have been like. I read Romance of Three Dynasty a lot.
You know, okay.
It's a Chinese novel. I mean, history / novel thing. So it's a kind of art of war related kind of thing.
Okay.
And they talk about different like formations of war formations, right? You can have like different shapes of formation. The formation that is the strongest is the formation where you have your back against the river. There's just no way out of this situation other than forward, right?
Right.
And I think that's the situation that I was in when I was opening this restaurant. And there's just no other options. You just charge forward. And good thing is, instead of fighting, and in a war, I just had to please guests and provide them with the best service and best beef and, you know, really exciting hospitality and F&B. As scary as it was actually very joyous.
And that's our show for today. Thank you to Simon Kim. You can still enjoy Coates and Cato's entries in San Pellegrino's Destination Dining Series through this Friday, October 13. Again, visit the episode page for this show at andrewtalkstochefs.com for a link to find more information on the programs, restaurants, and dates. Thanks as always to San Pellegrino for their support. Thank you to After School Special for our music. Please check out their album, Double Barrel, Single Entendre, on iTunes. Please follow us on Instagram. The handle there is @chefpodcast. And we would love it if you would please take a moment to rate us or review us on Apple Podcasts and help more people find this show. Thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.